All right, now this is part six of my lecture, The Hellenization of Christianity by the Scholastics, and it's titled, The Theologians Effectively Replaced the Magisterium and the Bible. First, we're going to teach you what the magisterium is. The magisterium is the infallible teaching authority of the Catholic Church, and there's two sources. There's the solemn magisterium, and there's the ordinary magisterium. The ordinary magisterium is unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers on faith or morals. Whatever they teach unanimously, all the church fathers, that's an infallible dogma. All right? The first church fathers were the apostles, and then the following church fathers. So whatever they teach unanimously is dogma. That's an infallible definition. That's called the ordinary magisterium. The solemn magisterium is the infallible teachings of the popes when they invoke their charism of infallibility and say, we declare, we define, we decree on faith or morals, and we bind you to under pain of anathema or some similar import, or they promulgate a creed for the universal church. So that's a solemn magisterium, papal infallibility, ordinary magisterium, the unanimous consensus of the true church fathers. That's the only two fonts of infallibility in the Catholic Church. You can look at my article. I have an article on that about the solemn ordinary magisterium already on my website if you want to learn more about that. But what happened with these theologians when they started to come together in the universities and they gathered together, they took on a whole life of themselves. It became one big group, conglomerated group, and they became their own magisterium. Their teachings now became more important than solemn ordinary magisterium and the ordinary magisterium. More important than infallible papal definitions, more important than unanimous consensus of the church fathers, and more important than the Bible. The Bible is not only the revelations that God gives us, that's one font of revelation of God speaking to us through the Bible, that's the written tradition, and there's oral traditions, but the Bible also contains ordinary magisterium teachings from the apostles and Jesus Christ. Their unanimous teachings in the Bible, that's also part of the ordinary magisterium in the Bible itself. So these theologians now come along and say, we're now the ones effectively that are going to replace those fonts of infallibility. Now, first we're going to read, as I just said before, that they formed a unique class, the theologians, that they never had before. It says the theologians did not form a separated class until about the 13th century, when those who commented on the Catholic faith gathered into the universities and formed themselves into unified groups, such as the theologians of the University of Paris, of the University of Oxford, or the University of Salamanca. We read from the contested theological authority of Thomas Aquinas by Elizabeth Lowe. The theology or theologians first emerged as a separate and professionalized class in the early 13th century. Their immediate impact upon medieval society began to extend far beyond the walls of the classroom. Less spectacular, but no less real, was the amplification of the power wielded by regular theologians. The task of transmitting the Christian tradition via the activities which defined them as theology, defining terms, exegeting tests, and determining questions, instilled with the magistry an authority all their own. They started to take on authority all their own. Back before that, who was the prime teacher of the faith? The Pope and the local bishops. They're the ones who are supposed to be the prime teachers. That's where you go. Now the theologians are usurping even their local bishops and even the Pope. They're now the main teaching authorities. We read from Censure and Heresy at the University of Paris from 1200 to 1400 by Thiessen. From the beginning of the 13th century, theologians played a special role in the church. Their new position was defined by the fact that they were members of the academic community who possessed a body of specialized knowledge that was critical to fulfilling the main purpose of the church. At the opening of the 13th century, a new group of professionals developed, the university masters, who after successful graduation were licensed to read, dispute, deliberate, and teach. When the exposition of the scriptures became an increasingly complicated and technical affair, this group gained in importance. Simultaneously with the development of the university as an institution, theology emerged as a science. It was no longer obvious that by the term ordo doctorum, the order of doctors, the bishops were meant. It used to be the bishops. The local bishop was the head teacher, as had been the case with Gregory the Great. Now it could also mean the doctors or masters of theology, in the sense of persons who had the function and the authority to teach. In other words, in addition to the apostolic teaching of the bishops, there was a scientific teaching of the theologians. From the 13th century onwards, they were the professional interpreters of the scriptures. At the beginning of the 13th century, the emergence of the faculty of theology as an academic institution and if theology is a scientific discipline went hand in hand, the professionalization of the status of theologian and the development of theology as a science significantly affected the concept of doctrinal control. End quote. The theologians then formed a new class that teaches the Catholic faith with the power and authority that was previously only given to unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers, which is the ordinary magisterium, and infallible papal decrees, which is solemn magisterium. The theologians then became a new magisterium in the Catholic Church. The effect of this new magisterium was that it actually replaced the ordinary magisterium and solemn magisterium. That is, replaced unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers and infallible papal decrees. We read from Heretics and Scholars in the Middle Ages, from 1000 to 1200 by Hendrik Fichtenau. It has been shown that during the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, the holdings of the Western libraries were overwhelmingly patristic in nature, the Church Fathers. By the end of this period, however, a sea change had taken place. The copies of patristic writings were rarely made anymore. They no longer read the Church Fathers anymore. That's the ordinary magisterium. While the age of the autoritas, the authorities, had not yet run its course, they now nowhere dominated the field. Authors like Manigault of Lautenbach and Rupert of Dutz City cited the Bible almost exclusively without any reference to the fathers of the church. They're ignoring the church fathers' commentaries. They're out now. They're the ones that their commentaries now matter, not the church fathers. Alongside such rigorists, there were modernists who had little interest in the literature of the past and preferred to consult the works of the contemporaries, other scholastics. They now start referring to one another for their authority. Each one of themselves, only to themselves. This was an inward detachment from the illustrious past to a new self-assurance born of scholarly activity. New thinkers acknowledged the existence of two equally worthy domains, the Authentica, the Bible, the Fathers, the Church Fathers, and the Magisterialia, works of the contemporary scholars, of the scholastics. And their group was the most important. In addition to the growing self-assurance felt by scholars, another factor that contributed to the declining respect for the Christian authorities was the broadening of intellectual horizons brought about by the growing familiarity with the ancient philosophers, and now bringing in Aristotle, Plato as also authorities. Disputants had no scruples about using the opinions of pagan philosophers as auctoritatis, as authorities, and when they're defending or teaching their dogmas. Now we read from the contested theological authority of Thomas Aquinas by Elizabeth Lowe. In the 12th century, the established triadic schema in which scriptural, patristic, and ancient authorities had been hierarchically arranged gave way to a more complex structure in which the moderni themselves had a place. Depending on the context, the term moderni usually referred either to an immediate preceding or a most contemporaneous generation of masters. Now the scholastics take over their own magisterium. They're more important than the fathers. First they were like on equal basis. Now they're more important than the church fathers and the Bible and solemn magisterial doctrines and councils. By the late 13th century, however, there is evidence that some of the moderni consciously attempted to establish themselves and their contemporaries as authorities. Scholastics no longer regarded themselves as doors standing on the shoulders of giants, the church fathers. That's as he used to say. All of us who follow the church fathers are doors standing on the shoulders of these giants. It's no longer that, they're saying. Or monks sitting in defeat of the fathers. It may well be because the autoritates, the authorities, themselves had changed. It's now the scholastics are the ones who are being idolized. Most of the scholastic and other modern theologians profess to believe in the ordinary magisterium and solemn magisterium while undermining them by ranking their teachings equal to or above them. We read this from the History of Popes by the apostate Dr. Ludwig Pasteur. Passages from the works of the heathen poets and teachers replaced the customary quotations from the fathers. The glamour of the new learning obscured the old simple doctrines, and the heathen mythology was mixed up with Christian dogma. The race of the dilettanti and freethinkers looked upon the doctrinal teaching of the church as a thing quite apart from their sphere. In their writings, they invoked the heathen gods and advocated the principles of the ancient philosophers. They also took pains from time to time to profess their submission to the creeds and were skillful in throwing a veil over the antagonism between the two. They paid lip service to the magisterium, but they really overwrote it in their teachings and their way of acting and speaking. The new theologians, the scholastic theologians, undermine the ordinary magisterium and solemn magisterium in at least three ways. One, by teaching that a group of theologians, such as the University of Paris, is infallible, or the common or unanimous consensus of all the scholastic theologians is infallible. The effect of this heresy superseded the unanimous consensus of the church fathers and infallible papal decrees. They took over the position that the church fathers had, and even infallible papal decrees from popes. Two, by teaching that the theologians are the infallible source for learning the meaning of dogmas on faith and morals, and thus not infallible papal decrees and unanimous consensus of the church fathers. Three, by explicitly denying the infallibility of the ordinary magisterium or solemn magisterium. As time went on, people completely denied the unanimous consensus of church fathers and even papal infallibility. Some of them completely threw, didn't even pay lip service to it anymore. We're going to explain to you what I mean about the meaning as we go on here. Now, for example, some of these apostates taught that the teachings of the theologians at the University of Paris on faith and morals were infallible. I quote from John Gerson, Reformer and Mystic, by James L. Connolly. It was chiefly in matters of faith that the University of Paris held a prominent position. She set herself as the censor of doctrine, the opponent of heresy. It was she who formed the bulk of the theologians. Men trained at Paris went out of the new universities and formed the minds of their pupils along the same lines of their own training had been. Now, there's nothing wrong with refuting this stuff, but here's where it gets really bad. Plus, you got to understand, who are these theologians that are supposed to be teaching the faith? They're heretics and idolaters. They're not teaching the faith. I go on to read, the university examined preachers and gave them the right to address the people according to what the theologians were saying, not their local bishop anymore. In 1387, a condemnation to the doctrine of John of Montesano resulted in the expulsion of the Dominican order from the university center, and the mentality of the doctors is seen in the declaration which those who defended Montesano had to sign before they were admitted to teach and preach at Paris. Here's what they had to say. That the University of Paris, quote, cannot err in matters of faith and morals was clearly stated. You had to state that or you couldn't even be a theologian there. There it is. They replaced papal infallibility, or at least equal to it. But if they were to go above the Pope, they would predominate, and they replaced unanimous consensus of the church fathers. Now, they would say we're equal to it, but whatever they say really usurps them. Now, they cannot earn faith and morals, the theologians at the University of Paris. Given this prestige, it is not difficult to appreciate how the influence of the university and her doctors would be great, not alone in France, but in all the Christian nations. This rosy picture of the teachings of the theologians of the University of Paris is not only heretical, because it bestows upon the theologians the charism of infallibility, but it also contradicts the fact that many of his theologians taught heresies, idolatries, and immoralities. For example, their theologians glorified philosophy, and some glorified mythology. Some of them, such as Albert the Great Wretch, taught astrology and other occult sciences and practiced them. In 1277, the apostate bishop Stephen Tempere condemned 219 heresies held by the theologians at the University of Paris. Some of the theologians held the conciliarist and Gallican heresies. And the apostate John Gerson, who was the chancellor of the University of Paris from 1385 to 1411, said the following regarding the theologians of the University of Paris. In his letter 5, he said, the theologians fill their students with the sterile and diseased doctrines. In letter 2, he says, the theologians have sown pernicious dogmas. In letter 3, he says, he's the chancellor of the university. They cannot err in faith and morals, huh? In his letter 3, he says, the theologians spurn the Bible and other doctors of the church and know nothing about solid truth and morals in the Bible. And in their teachings, numberless passive error are opened. In his letter 6, he says that their students are devoid of religion, for they know nothing more about Christian religion than pagans. There's the true description. And here you have to take an oath that they can't err in faith or morals. It's against the facts, because they all held the same heresies. And if they didn't hold the same heresies, they would present them as allowable opinions so they can continue on with their heresies, not rebuked and kicked out of the university. So they can go on with their free thinking, idolizing their intellect. So much for the infallibility, University of Paris, that cesspool of heresy, idolatry, and all kinds of iniquity. Now, in 1897, the apostate anti-pope Leo XIII taught the heresy that the unanimous consensus of the doctors, and thus the theologians, is infallible, and thus undermined and denied the infallible authority of the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers. He's undermining the ordinary magisterium. We read this in his encyclical called Officiorum Ac Munerum in 1896, number 39. Censors must keep before their eyes nothing but the dogmas of the Holy Church and the common Catholic doctrine as contained in the decrees of the General Councils. That's good. The constitutions of the Roman Pontiffs. That's good. And the unanimous teachings of the doctors of the Church. That's heresy. Here he is telling you that the theologians, whatever they're unanimous on, the modern theologians, that's dogma. That's what he's telling you right there. But apostate anti-pope Pius IX contradicted this heresy. Now you can have two anti-popes contradicting one another. He said unanimous teachings here, right? And we know it's not the unanimous teachings of the theologians, it's unanimous teachings of the Church Fathers. So, but apostate anti-pope Pius IX contradicted this heresy of apostate anti-pope Leo XIII and taught an even worse heresy. He said all you need to have a dogma is the common consensus of the theologians. Forget it, they don't have to be unanimous. As long as the majority of them teach something, that's a dogma. We're going to read about this from apostate anti-pope Pius IX in his Tausliebentir in 1863. Faith and obedience would not have to be limited to those matters which have been defined by express decrees of the ecumenical councils or of the Roman Pontiffs of the see, but would have to extend also to those matters which are handed down as divinely revealed by the ordinary teaching power of the whole church. He includes them as part of the ordinary magisterium, spread throughout the world, and therefore by a universal and common consensus are held by Catholic theologians to belong to the faith. He's including the theologians in the ordinary magisterium. And so basically he's saying, whatever they teach you, even the majority of them is infallible. So they're overriding the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers. He's including all theologians and these modern theologians. Now, this heresy contradicted putative infallible decrees from the invalid Council of Trent in the 16th century, which apostate anti-pope Pius IX knew about, and a putative infallible decree that he himself promulgated at the invalid Vatican Council in 1870, 7 years after he wrote Tausliebentir. Now let's read what this teaching is. Here's the proper teaching, even though this is not a really infallible statement because it's invalid, but it is a dogma we're going to be reading here. This is from the invalid Council of Trent in the 16th century from the Profession of Faith. I likewise accept Holy Scripture according to that sense which our Holy Mother Church has held and does hold, whose office it is to judge of the true meaning of the interpretation of sacred Scriptures. I shall never accept nor interpret it otherwise than in accordance with the unanimous consensus of the Fathers. Unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers, not the theologians, not the modern theologians. Look, this is the invalid Vatican Council of 1870, Session 2, Profession of Faith, which the apostate anti-pope Pius IX approved. Likewise, I accept sacred Scripture according to that sense which Holy Mother Catholic Church held and holds, since it is her right to judge of the true sense and interpretation of the Holy Scriptures. Nor will I receive and interpret them except according to the unanimous consensus of the Fathers. Before, he said, the common consensus of the theologian counts. Now he's not including the theologians. It's no longer the common consensus. It's now the unanimous consensus, and it's the Fathers. Well, make up your mind, jackass. Make up your mind, you big lying Janus two-faced mythological false god bastard. I tell you, these one hand doesn't know what the other's doing with these guys. But apostate anti-pope Pius IX and Tausliebentir heretically taught that the theologians and not only the Church Fathers can teach infallibly, and that only a common consensus is needed to make an infallible definition instead of a unanimous consensus, which contradicts the above decrees in the Council of Trent, the Vatican Council of 1870, and more importantly, it contradicts valid infallible definitions from Pentecost Day in 33 AD onward that teach that only unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers and popes can make infallible definitions. It also contradicts logic. If the common consensus of the Church Fathers does not make a dogma, then neither does the common consensus of the theologians make a dogma. And if the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers does make a dogma, then the unanimous consensus of the theologians does not matter. because a dogma was already infallibly defined by the unanimous consensus of the church fathers. It is the theologians then who must believe the unanimous consensus of the church fathers and not vice versa. The church fathers are not bound to the teachings of the future theologians, but the theologians are bound to the unanimous teachings of the past church fathers. And if the theologians defect from these teachings, then they are heretics. And if all the theologians defect, then the unanimous consensus of the theologians is heretical, not the unanimous consensus of the church fathers whom they contradict. It's that simple. It doesn't even make sense. It's even illogical. They're idolizing the scholastics to replace the whole magisterium term, everything up on its end. Now we're going to quote from a modern-day scholastic, egghead, pseudo-intellectual, apostate, idolatrous bastard, the father Anthony Chikara. And you're going to see how he idolizes theologians. They're the main, according to him, they're the ones that make dogmas, and they're the only ones that can tell us what dogmas mean. A modern-day apostate scholastic, the Reverend Anthony Chikara, embraced Pisonite heresy. He teaches that a common consensus of theologians is infallible, and that the scholastic theologians are the most authoritative and thus over the church fathers. I read from his article called Baptism of Desire and Theological Principles from the year 2000. The consensus of theologians in matters of faith and morals is a certain criteria of divine tradition. A consensus. He didn't say unanimous. Whenever, insofar as the doctrine of the theologians is abandoned, especially that of the scholastic theologians, theological errors, indeed heresies, rise up and the Catholic life falls. As servants, organs, and witnesses of the church, the theologians possess an authority that is both dogmatic and certain. That is such an abominable heresy. This is so bad. This guy ought to be bullwhipped, tortured. If I had him, I would give him 1 month to repent. I'd torture him while in that month if he didn't repent. And then after that, if he didn't, I'd kill him, but publicly hang him and burn his body. Notice that Chikara says, whenever and insofar as the doctrine of the theologian is abandoned, heresies arise. He did not say that the doctrines of the popes and the doctrine of the unanimous consensus of the church fathers is abandoned. Why didn't he say that? Because his new magisterium of scholastic and other modern theologians has superseded them. Hence, according to Chikara, if the common teachings of the scholastics and other modern theologians contradicts unanimous consensus of the church fathers or infallible papal decrees, then the teachings of the theologians must be followed because they, as he says, possess an authority that is both dogmatic and certain. That's what he said. In spite of the fact that we have multitudes of heresies that these guys are holding. Apostate Pope Pius XII knew the danger of this heresy. Even him, he's going to condemn Chikara here. Apostate Pope Pius XII knew the danger of this heresy and thus correctly taught the following, which contradicted the heresy of Towsley Bentir and Chikara's above teaching. He taught this in Humani Generis in 1950. It is also true that theologians must always return to the sources of divine revelation, for it belongs to them to point out how the doctrine of the living teaching authority is to be found, either explicitly or implicitly, in the scriptures and the tradition. Together with the sources of positive theology, God has given to his church a living teaching authority to elucidate and explain what is contained in the deposit of faith only obscurely and implicitly. This deposit of faith, our divine redeemer, has given for authentic interpretation, not to each of the faithful, not even to the theologians, but only to the teaching authority of the church, which is infallible papal decrees, unanimous teachings of the church fathers. Main point, he says, the theologians don't have this power that Chikara said they have. He even notices invalid, he's teaching the truth here. The church does exercise this function of teaching as she often does through the centuries, either in the ordinary or the extraordinary way. The ordinary ways are by the unanimous consensus of the church fathers on faith or morals, extraordinarily solemn definitions. But he's saying not even the theologian have this power. Hence, apostate Antipope Pius XII correctly teaches that the theologians have no part in the ordained magisterium or solemn magisterium, no matter if their teachings on faith and morals form a common consensus or unanimous consensus. They're out. Now, the other thing they teach is very sneaky. Chikara taught this too. They'll say, I don't believe the theologians have the power to make dogmas or define them, but they're the only ones we got to go to learn the meaning of dogmas. So let's say the unanimous consensus of the church fathers and popes speaking infallibly, they're the only ones that can make dogmas, but we need to go to the theologians for them to tell us, what does the Pope mean? What does the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers mean? And we got to listen to what they say, and what they say is true, even if it contradicts the infallible teachings. The other heresy in which the theologians have effectively replaced the ordinary magisterium, the Psalm magisterium, states that the theologians are the ultimate authority in teaching the meaning of dogmas. Even though this heresy does not teach that the theologians make infallible definitions, it does teach that they are the ultimate authority in explaining the meaning of the infallible definitions of the ordinary magisterium and solemn magisterium. Consequently, this heresy has the theologians as the ultimate source of the truth and not the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers and infallible papal decrees. The apostate scholastic Reverend Chicada teaches this heresy again in his article Baptism of Desire and Theological Principles, year 2000, he wrote this. In explaining and determining the meaning of dogmas, theologians are considered private teachers with regard to the methods they use, but not when they propose a doctrine as a doctrine of faith or the church. Theologians, as ministers and organs of the church, instruct the faithful in the doctrines of the faith, so in fact, those things preached, taught, held, and believed are those same things the theologians propose and teach. The teaching of the theologians, especially the scholastics, best explains and defends the doctrine of the faith, nourish and begets faith, and helps and perfects the Christian life. Theologians are witnesses not only to whether a doctrine is defined, but also to its meaning. And he's even saying they're the ones that determine if it's been defined or not. It is the teachings of the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers and infallible papal decrees by themselves that teach the meaning of their infallible definitions. If the theologians are the ones who infallibly tell men what dogmas mean, then they are the ones that are infallible and not the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers and infallible papal decrees. To deny a dogma and get away with it according to this heresy, all a theologian needs to do is to present a meaning to a dogma contrary to the meaning of the dogma given by the infallible definition itself. This has been the way of most heretics to profess allegiance to a dogma while explaining it away, by giving it a meaning never intended by the infallible definition. While a theologian can't explain a dogma, he must do so according to the meaning given them by the infallible definitions, and his explanations are still not infallible. And if an infallible definition needs to be clarified or expanded upon, it is only the Pope who can infallibly settle the dispute, not the theologians, although they can aid the Pope by giving him counsel. This heresy has the theologians and not popes infallibly settling legitimate disputes over dogmas that need to be clarified or expanded upon. Yet Chicada, as well as the other apostates, heretically placed the theologians as the principal source of truth. He has the theologians infallibly clearing up obscurities that may be infallible papal definitions instead of the popes. And he has theologians infallibly clearing up obscurities in the teachings and legitimate disputes of the fathers, doctors, and theologians instead of the popes. Chicada's heresy has not only obscured the truth, but also made it impossible for anyone to absolutely know the truth, which includes dogmatic definitions from popes. He and his like use an illogical, false, and circular reasoning to accomplish their black magic. He has the theologians as the ultimate authority in explaining what infallible definitions mean. Catholics, then, are really in subjection to the theologians and not the infallible definitions. Let us follow this heresy to its logical, or more properly, to its illogical conclusion. A pope makes an infallible definition. He makes a dogma. Then, according to Chicada, Catholics must go to the theologians to know what the pope means. Thus, either the pope did not teach clearly enough for your average Catholic to understand what he means, or your average Catholic is too stupid to understand the infallible teachings of the pope. Therefore, Catholics are told to go to the theologians in order to know the meaning of dogmas. But if your average Catholic is too stupid to understand the meaning of popes' infallible definitions, he will be equally stupid in understanding the theologians' explanations of what the popes mean. Consequently, whom does the average Catholic go to in order to know what the theologians mean when they explain what the popes mean? Must he go back to the pope and ask him to explain what the theologians mean? But if he does, he's then told he must go back to the theologian to explain what the Pope means when the Pope explained what the theologians mean. And this happens. You'll see them fighting over this. No, so-and-so said with this. No, I think the Pope said this. But what? Look what this theologian said about what the Pope meant. Yeah, but look what this theologian said. But look what this Pope said about what the theologian. They go back and forth. And, you, and there's no authority. The theologians, being authority in itself, have the power. They bind you to the theologian and say they're the most authoritative, not even the Pope. I say, there you have an illogical, false, and circular reasoning that makes it impossible for anyone to know dogmatic truth with all certainty. It is the infamous pass the buck, catch 22, and eternal loop. Men's head are spinning so fast and in so many directions in this loop that they no longer know what is true or what is false, who is up or who is down. Catholics become disarmed and disoriented and lose the whole deposit of Catholic faith in one swoop and thus fall outside the Catholic Church as non-Catholic heretics because they are no longer standing on the rock of Peter and its infallible papal decrees and the infallible unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers, but on the shifting sand of the theologian's teachings as a principal source of truth. And we also say, what about the heretical interpretations Catholics will get from heretic theologians? Chicago goes on to say they don't, the scholastic theologians especially, say they don't teach heresies. But as my book proved, and as many of my examples already proved, they teach a whole bunch of heresies and idolatries. So if they're infallible, then you're going to have to follow them, right? But here's my point. What about the heretical interpretation Catholics will get from heretic theologians who have existed within the ranks of the Church and thus go by the name Catholic, especially from the 11th century onward, to the point that they outnumbered the good Catholic theologians, and to the point that there were no more good Catholic theologians because they are ostracized by apostate antipopes, apostate bishops, and apostate theologians. Which theologians, then, should Catholics trust? Hence, it is not only heretical, but also illogical to send Catholics to theologians as a principal source of truth. Satan is using Chicada and others like him to sow discord and chaos in an attempt to justify the many heretical theologians whom they follow in order to defend their many heresies. It is a willful plan to destroy the Church by striking at the rock of the Church, the infallible teachings of the popes, and the unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers, by attacking their dogmas and subjecting them to the theologians. Just as the Talmudic Jews subject their beliefs to the many different Talmudic Jewish rabbi commentators who interpret the law with the result and intention of denying the law. What Jesus said about the heretical Jewish theologians and canonists applies equal to the nominal Catholic theologians and canonists. Luke 11:52. Woe to you lawyers, theologians and canonists, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You yourselves have not entered in, and those who are entering you have hindered. And in Mark 7:7-8, and in vain do they worship me, teaching the doctrines and precepts of men. For leaving the commandment of God, you hold to the tradition of men. Leaving the traditions of the Church, which goes back to Jesus Christ, the apostles, the first Church Fathers, the following Church Fathers. That's where the Church began, not with the theologians. The tradition of men is your modern theologians. Once Chicada promotes theologians as a principal source of truth, all he has to do is use the many heretical teachings from the heretical nominal Catholic theologians who have taken away the key of knowledge and left the commandment of God for the tradition of men to override the clear meaning of infallible papal definitions and infallible unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers. Since these heretical theologians have become more numerous than the good theologians, his diabolical plan succeeds with alarming efficiency by using the heretical theologians to explain away the actual meaning of infallible papal decrees and the infallible unanimous consensus of the Church Fathers. For example, the apostate Father Anthony Chicada denies the salvation dogma. He believes men that die worshiping false gods and practicing false religions can be saved. That monster. He heretically believes that certain men who died worshiping false gods, practicing false religions can be saved and thus are in heaven. He holds this heresy. In spite of the fact that he opposes the infallible, unanimous consensus of the true Church Fathers and numerous infallible papal decrees. How does he justify his denial of this dogma? He does so by bringing to his aid the many heretical theologians, especially since the 16th century, who go by the name Catholic and who likewise deny the salvation dogma. Once he establishes his heresy that Catholics must submit to theologians to know the meaning of the infallible definitions of popes and unanimous consensus to church fathers, he then uses these many heretical theologians to heretically explain away what the popes and the unanimous consensus of the church fathers actually taught. Chicata then tells Catholics they are bound to believe the heretical theologians' heretical interpretations, especially since the unanimous consensus of the modern theologians denies the salvation dogma. Every one of them does. The apostate Alphonse de Liguori denied it also. He presented the dogma as an opinion. He says, I believe that you got to be Catholic to be saved. However, I believe that the other opinion, which is held by the apostate Lugo, who taught that a Jew who explicitly denies Christ could actually be in the way of salvation and be saved the way he is, Alphonse taught that that opinion that teaches that men will believe in false gods and false religions and die that way can be saved, he said it's a viable and allowable opinion. That's what Alphonse said. So he denied the salvation dogma. He only presented it as opinion, and the opposing opinion, he presented it as allowable, not as heretical. They all denied it, you see? So now they just pass stack up all these books from the 16th century forward who denied the salvation. Look at all these books. Go back further to the beginning of church and stack up books. From the true church fathers and infallible papal degrees. Stack those books up. And you know why we don't have as many books as they do? Because you got thousands of theologians, thousands of them. They got thousands of books. Oh, I don't know how many books they got now. Thousands of them. All they got to do is fill out a little paper and they get a theological degree and they're theologians. Worse than that, that wouldn't be really that bad, really. But they have to go to the schools and be corrupted. Thousands. And they refer to all these guys. Hence, Chicago's black magic accomplishes its task with those who are worthy of being deceived because they receive not the love of the truth. The love of Catholic dogmas as infallibly defined by popes and the unanimous consensus of the church fathers and not by the theologians. He and those like him have replaced the unanimous consensus of the church fathers and infallible papal decrees with the common or unanimous consensus of the theologians. No matter how many heretical imprimatur books are stacked on top of one another, the heresies in them can never stop being heresies. As if after a certain amount of heretical books are stacked on top of one another, the heresies in them magically become dogmas. Likewise, no matter how much dung is stacked on top of one another, that dung can never stop being dung. As if after a certain amount of dung is stacked on top of one another, the dung magically smells like roses or becomes bread. You can't do it. That reminds me of one person I knew. I won't mention his name here. But he did believe in the salvation of dogma. He had the courage to debate it a lot. But he was debating these people in New York City, these intellectual eggheads. And he held the salvation dogma. They didn't. They're your modern scholastics and theologians. I think it was, I forget what the church, but it was their scholastic eggheads. And the one guy that was debating him stacked up a whole bunch of books with imprimaturs on it from the 16th century forward about all. Look at all these people that said a Jew who dies practicing optometric Judaism or a Buddhist worshiping a false god or a Protestant who dies in a prank can be saved. He's stacking all these books up, using that as his proof. Can you go back a little further before that and stack it up and let me know? The church didn't start in the 16th century. We're not just talking about the salvation dogma here, neither. We're talking about massive heresies and idolatries, one after another, which I gave you examples of many already and are in my book. These are the same bums that got idols up in their churches, and nobody says anything about it. These bums that were idolizing mythology and Aristotle and Plato, and everything's fine. Now, the last thing I'm going to mention here, which will end our whole lecture for this season, is just briefly mentioned here about them banning the Bible. The Bible's, first of all, one of the fonts of revelation, which God teaches us through the Bible. That's where we get our deposit of faith from. And it also contains the ordinary magisterial teachings of the apostles, where we're learning. Now, the Protestants, a lot of things they say about the nominal Catholics is true. And the nominal Catholics hide it because they're embarrassed. They don't want to admit it. So they cover it up. And it scandalizes the Protestants. It makes it harder for us to convert Protestants. I really believe the nominal Catholics are worse than most of your Protestants. Really, your conservative Protestants. I'm not making excuses for Protestants. They need to come into the church to be saved. But they scandalize these Protestants, make excuses for them. When the Protestants came out and said that they banned the Bible, they don't want Catholics to read the Bible. Some of your traditionalists try, that's not true. The Catholic Church always allowed their people to read the Bible. Sometimes they chained it up so they didn't have a lot of Bibles. They didn't want it to be stolen, but they always let you read the Bible. That's a lie. They really did ban reading the Bible. They really did. I don't have all the teachings right here in my lecture now, but I have it in my, it's going to be in my book. And the point I want to make here is we all know it today. I grew up as a nominal Catholic, and I will tell you firsthand, they hated the Bible. If you had a Bible in your house, it was on the bottom shelf with dust on it. If you took it out to dust it off and read it, they thought you're a Jesus freak or you're a Protestant. How many people will tell you that? That's proof of it. Proof in the action that they, if they didn't come out and explicitly ban it, they discouraged you from reading it. I knew nothing at all about the Bible. St. Paul says that everybody should use the Bible to edify and to refute and to strengthen and to enlighten. I have several scriptures from St. Paul on that where he's talking about the Bible as absolutely a necessary weapon that every Catholic should have. Your excuse was, they're going to take the Bible out of context and come up with heresies. Not if it has a good Catholic commentary. And if they're going to take the Catholic Bible out of context, they can take a catechism out of context. But let alone, they can read the Summa. They can read Aquinas. They can read Aristotle. They could read Plato. They could read these modern theologians, but they can't read the Bible, the Holy Word of God. And you know why they don't want them to read the Bible? Because all you got to do is read the Bible, even without a commentary, and it condemns every little thing they're doing. I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before thee. Beware of philosophy, Colossians 2:8. There's only one God, one faith, one religion. Do not be in religious communion with non-Catholics. It condemns simony, it condemns their adultery, it condemns their homosexuality, it condemns their pedophilia, it condemns the idols they have up all over the Vatican. You read about the Jews in the Old Testament, they did the same things the apostate Jews that we're doing, desecrating our home. When I first read the Bible, it was power, it was dynamite. And you get up and all you got to do is quote a few scriptures to the guy and he's confounded, he's dead, he's running for the door. Because he knows what he's doing is wrong. That's why they don't want you to read the Bible. And so when these theologians started to come to power, they did ban the Bible and they banned the reading of the church fathers and hid them. You know how hard it is, until the internet came along, how hard it is to get the church fathers? You're reading all the modern theologians, the modern catechisms, the modern antipopes. That's all you're looking at. As if the church just began when Satan was unchained in the 11th century. And the Protestants were right on that point. Because if you read the... I know. I mean, I'll give you an example. I went up to this one apostate priest and I told him, Father, is there such thing as devils? And he said, no, there's no such thing as devils. I says, but Jesus Christ said in the Bible that he's casting out devils. Well, Jesus just said that because we didn't have a scientific understanding of physical ills and all that. But that's just one example. But when you read about, thou shalt not have strange gods before me, you shall not have idols in my home, images of false gods, which are all over the Vatican, Aristotle, Plato, their philosophical teachings, their practice in astrology. Read the Bible. It condemns astrology. It's in the Bible. And that's why they banned it. And they scared. Why do you think the Protestant movement was so successful? Because these nominal Catholics were so bad they scandalized them, and which is even worse, when the Protestants would bring up the things where these nominal Catholics really were wrong, they sweep it under the carpet, ignore them, pretend it never happened. Or they make excuses for it. Most of the time they pretend it never happened. How are you ever going to convert a goodwill Protestant to a church like that? I call it the Renaissance Church. No goodwill person will come into that church and stay in that church. It's false. His teachings are not true. And I tell the Protestants, it doesn't mean the Catholic Church is not the true church. We have many readings back in the Old Testament. Jews went bad and defiled their own home. I'm going to read from how bad the Jews were during the Old Testament era. How mostly all your Jews are always bad. There are only a few good ones. But let's read what he says about Jerusalem. In Jeremiah chapter 32, 31. For this city, Jerusalem, has been to me a provocation and indignation from the day that they built it unto the day in which it shall be taken out of my sight, when he destroyed it, when Nebuchadnezzar came and destroyed the temple. And also, just because I say most of your so-called Catholics are actually nominal Catholics and apostates and bad Catholics, so if there are only a few good Catholics, does not mean that Catholics are not God's chosen people during the New Covenant era. They admit that the Jews were God's chosen people during the Old Testament era. And look what Jeremiah says about the Jews during the... God says about his chosen people, the Jews during the Old Covenant era. He says in Jeremiah 32:30, for the children of Israel, the children of Judah, have continually done evil in my eyes from their youth. And we read in, I think, Judges 4:1, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Judges 6:1, and the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So that doesn't take away that the Catholic Church is the one true church, the papacy and all her true teachings, which we're teaching here. So if you want to come into the true Catholic Church, you got to come and be with us. But the people I hate the most that I despise the most, that I pray from the bottom of my heart to get destroyed first and most, are the nominal Catholic leaders out there and the Vatican II Church, the traditionalist movements, the Sedevi contest groups. I want those guys to die first and get out of my way. I don't want a fake Catholicism running around. I only want one true one, which is us. These guys are gone. But I'm preaching to you enough to let you know that even now, you may die tomorrow and that may not happen yet. You better come with us now. We're the true Catholic Church. But I tell you right now, these nominal Catholics are even worse than most of your Protestants. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. This recording was produced by Mary's Little Remnant, 302 East Joffrey Street, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, 87901-2878, and can be accessed on my website at www.johnthebaptist.us.